In St. Augustine's account of the will can resist reason, but Schopenhauer places the will above reason. The will is essential and real, the intellect dependent and secondary. The mind is basically a tool in service of the will. Schopenhauer develops his view by drawing upon the kinship shared by animals and human beings, a kinship rooted in the will. It's clear, he thinks, that animals have the same desires and drives as humans. We all will to live, to exist. Schopenhauer points out that we even attribute the same qualities of the will to ourselves and to animals.
Thus we know that the animal wills, indeed, even what it wills, namely, existence, well-being, life, propagation. Since we here presuppose with perfect certainty an identity with ourselves, we have no hesitation in attributing to it, unchanged, all the affections of will known to us in ourselves. And we speak positively and plainly of its desire, aversion, fear, anger, hatred, love, joy, sorrow, longing, and so on.
Animals are different from human beings because they have a limited capacity for intellectual representation. Using this concept, Schopenhauer argues in a subtle but surprisingly modern fashion that reason or intellect is subordinate to will. He believes that the general aim of the will is existence, well-being, life. It makes no difference whether this will occurs in a bird, a monkey, or a man. As an organism becomes more complex, its ways of surviving and meeting its needs also become more complex. According to this theory, the intellect is the most sophisticated tool animals have evolved to serve the will and to live.
In all animal beings, the will is the primary and substantial thing. The intellect, on the other hand, is something secondary and additional. In fact, a mere tool in the service of the will, which is more or less complete and complicated according to the requirements of the service. Just as a species of animals appears equipped with hoofs, claws, hands, wings, horns, or teeth according to the aims of its will, so is it furnished with a more or less developed brain, whose function is the intelligence requisite for its continued existence.
In human beings, the mind also acquires a power of abstract thinking and reflection.
But the last step taken by nature in this respect is disproportionately great, for in man not only does the power of representation in perception, which has hitherto existed alone, reach the highest degree of perfection, but the abstract representation, thinking, that is, reason is added, and with it, reflection.
We can reason and we can think reflectively, but this doesn't change the essential character of the mind. It's still a tool in the service of the will. According to Schopenhauer, the mind's ability to reflect on ideas has misled philosophers about its purpose.
Undoubtedly, this is mainly what has given rise to the fundamental error of all philosophers, by virtue of which they make thinking the essential and primary element of the so-called soul, in other words, of man's inner or spiritual life, always putting it first, but regard will as a mere product of thinking, and as something secondary, additional, and subsequent.
So far we've examined the typical immediate experience that each of us has had with individual acts of willing. We might want a new car, strive for success, or fear failure. From this perspective, Schopenhauer argues that the individual's doomed to unhappiness because of the unquenchable longings of the will. We've seen that philosophers before Schopenhauer had appealed to reason itself for help in achieving happiness. But Schopenhauer believes that even reason seems to be subject to the irrational whims of the will. Yet this is still an incomplete picture of the nature of the will. Our individual experience of the will is only a partial glimpse of a larger whole. In Schopenhauer's philosophy, there's only one will underlying all experience. This will manifests itself. In his term, it objectifies itself throughout all nature. Schopenhauer believes that whoever is reflected upon the immediate experience of his own will should also see how the will is present in other living beings. But Schopenhauer also extends the concept of will to inanimate objects. In rocks and rivers, the will manifests itself as a force of nature. The difference between what we experience as our will and the forces in nature, such as gravity or electrical attraction, is a difference of degree, not a difference in kind.
He will recognize that same will not only in those phenomena that are quite similar to his own, in men and animals, as their innermost nature, but continued reflection will lead him to recognize the force that shoots and vegetates in the plant, indeed the force by which the crystal is formed, the force that turns the magnet to the North Pole, the force whose shock he encounters from the contact of metals of different kinds, the force that appears in the elective affinities of matter as repulsion and attraction, separation and union, and finally even gravitation, which acts so powerfully in all matter, pulling the stone to the earth and the earth to the sun. He will recognize them all as that which is immediately known to him, so intimately and better than everything else, and where it appears most distinctly, is called will. It appears in every blindly acting force of nature, and also in the deliberate conduct of man. And the great difference between the two concerns only the degree of the manifestation, not the inner nature of what is manifested.
In Schopenhauer's view, the forces that animate living beings and govern the motions of physical bodies are all expressions of the will. The concept of the will is the central concept from which other concepts must derive their meaning.
Hitherto, the concept of will had been subsumed under the concept of force. I, on the other hand, do exactly the reverse, and intend every force of nature to be conceived as will.
So far, Schopenhauer has given his reasons for applying the concept of the will more broadly than we're used to. In his view, the will that moves someone to act is the same kind of thing that moves an animal to act, or moves a stone to fall. But he's not shown us why we should conclude that the will's a single force underlying all events in nature. According to Schopenhauer, we don't make a conclusion about the unity of the will through our experience of the will. Paradoxically, we derive this view from our experience of the world of appearances. The will must be one because appearances are many. As we've seen, Schopenhauer believes that our experience is governed by the categories of space, time, and causality. These are the forms of what he calls the principle of sufficient reason. We understand events and objects in our experience to be causally related in space and time. From the perspective of the knowing subject, these categories define and organize our experience of the world. But because our perceptions are based on appearances rather than reality itself, those perceptions can't define the nature of the will. The will is the thing in itself that lies hidden behind these appearances. Since the will lies behind the appearances, it's not subject to the principles by which we apprehend appearances. The categories of space, time, and causality apply to appearances, not to the will as thing in itself.